This meeting is now being recorded.
This is the American Immigration Lawyers Association, Rome District Chapter. My name is Clayton Cartwright. I am the chairperson of the Practice Management Committee. Today's podcast is Notarization and Apostille Services Outside the United States. Today is Thursday, December 12, 2014. I'm here with our special guest panelist, Kevin Burke, from American Attorney Services in Bristol. I'm also joined by my fellow panelists, Claire Nielsen, who's a member of the Practice Management Committee, and also Lindsay Kershaw, who's also a member of the Practice Management Committee. Kevin, thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. I would just like to give a very brief explanation of who I am and what I do. I'm an American lawyer qualified in Florida and Ohio. I first practiced in the U.S. in 92. Had an office in Cape Coral, Florida, and Cleveland, Ohio. Moved to the UK in 1999 after I became an English solicitor through the QLTT exam. In 2004, I flew back to Florida to become what's known as a Florida Civil Law Notary, or otherwise known as a Florida International Notary. In 2008, after taking a two-year course with the University of Cambridge in the UK, I became an English Notary Public. I gave up being a solicitor in 2010. When I set my own firm, American Attorney Services, and from here, I continue to practice the same areas of law I did in the U.S., mainly U.S. immigration and Florida private client services. U.S. immigration, you know, same as most other people, is a mixture of individual and business immigration. On the Florida side and Ohio to some extent, probate services, wills, trusts, property purchases. We get a lot of British and other Europeans looking to buy property in America, that kind of thing. And my notary work has been of some benefit because of that.
Thank you. Thanks, Kevin, for that introduction. You know, in the United States, I mean, we sort of take notarization services for granted. I mean, it's very easy to become a notary, though I can say in Georgia, a few years ago, they actually required that I used to have a notary license based upon the county where I worked, and then they changed it to the county in which I lived. So I went from having to get three references from a county of 200,000 people to 10,000. And, you know, I really didn't know my neighbors very well. It took me a while to get three notaries or three people that I could trust to put their name down, three references down. I just, you know, because we just think of notarization sort of like, oh, we'll just get it notarized. Oh, we've got, you know, three notaries in our office. Kevin, can you give us a brief background about what the big differences are between the U.S. notary and the U.K. notary and basically notary services overseas and major jurisdictions?
Yeah, that's a huge question, but I will keep it as quick and simple as I can. The biggest difference between the U.S. And Canada together, as opposed to the rest of the U.S., isn't just that the U.S. and Canada are common law jurisdictions as opposed to civil law. It's mainly because the U.S. is quite remarkable for the sheer number of notaries that it has appointed. According to the National Notary Association, there's approximately 4.8 million notaries in the U.S., and that's equivalent with a U.S. population of about 312 million plus to one notary for every 65 people. That's not even counting just the adults. That's a far greater ratio of notaries to the general public than exists in any other country. In the UK, it's quite different. There are there's basically only about 900 notaries in England and Wales, and it's something like one in every 61,340,000 people. So already you can see that it's not around the corner in every bank where you're going to find a notary. The other thing, of course, is that unlike in the U.S. and most Canadian provinces, notaries outside the U.S. are lawyers, and generally they're also the highest form of lawyer. They're lawyers that were already attorneys or solicitors and have gone and taken an additional step. I was quite shocked at how difficult, after passing two bar exams and becoming a solicitor, how difficult it was to become an English notary. There was 200 that started that course I did with the University of Cambridge. It was a distance learning course, but there was a lot of hours up there and many papers which were marked on a pass-fail basis, but only 25% of us made it, and everybody was a solicitor or otherwise a lawyer. Many were lawyers in multiple jurisdictions and could speak a number of languages besides English, of course. So that would be the biggest difference. And, of course, the amount of study they have to do on that is very different.
Wow. You know, that's a really important point because, you know, we can go through technical issues in terms of, you know, what's required. But we just in terms of perception, I mean, you know, the notary service in the U.S., because there's so many notaries and so, you know, they're so readily available, they get devalued in many cases. And I think sometimes we have to, you know, manage our clients' expectations about, you know, outside the U.S. because they may think, oh, well, why can't you just get it automatically, aren't they on every street corner? Lindsay, you and I have had some discussions about that. Do you want to care to chime in about how these issues affect your practice?
Sure, Clayton. So thinking about it from the perspective of a U.S. immigration attorney, you know, we often say to our clients, oh, we need to have these affidavits notarized. Maybe it's a waiver case or a removal of conditional residence or something like that. And occasionally, people even need to have an apostille to confirm, you know, that a document is from a certain government agency. And can you tell us a little bit of the difference of what you might be doing in the UK as opposed to what a notary in the US would do with that document?
Okay. The answer, again, returns back to the answer to the first question. Only in as much as, like I said, there was only one notary for every 63,000 people. Most British people, even English lawyers, would not even know that there are notaries in England and Wales. So you have to be very, very careful when you ask a client, or somebody in the UK to go and get something notarized. Many times they don't or not are not aware there are notaries. And you may, in fact, I've had this happen even to myself where in a Florida property purchase, I was representing a buyer, and the seller happened to also be in the UK. So the closing agents in Florida had sent over the warranty deed for the seller to sign. The point being that the seller went and went to a local solicitor. Solicitor rang up the closing agents in Florida and said that there is no such thing as notaries in the UK. Here's a lawyer that's saying this. So the closing agents let them sign as notary. And, of course, the deed was invalid. We had actually had the client get the deed. Their money was gone. We had to spend a year in the courts trying to sort it out. But it was a big lesson to me that I can't presume that fellow English lawyers know what they're talking about. So if you do ask somebody to go notarize something in any other nation, you want to make sure that they do know what a notary is, and you may have to help them. In the UK, you would normally want to refer them to the website for the Notary Society, which is thenotarysociety.org.uk. Depending upon the nation, of course, if they can get to the notary, then, of course, they're going to find out that they can't just pop in. They may need to make an appointment, you know, for the following week or this kind of thing. The costs would be substantially higher than in the U.S., with regard to apostilles and so on, English notaries would have generally have a much greater knowledge of the international side because in the UK, and I imagine it's the same in most countries, there isn't much of a domestic role for notaries. We don't do anything here with English conveyancing or English legal work at all. The role of a notary in England and Wales or in the UK generally is to deal with international documents, documents intended for other countries. Now, you're probably familiar with the different Hague Conventions, and on one of the Hague Conventions is the one in relation to legalization. So it's the Hague Convention abolishing the requirement for legalization of foreign public documents. Now, the idea behind that was, in the past, you would have to go through various embassies or consulates, and it could be a whole quagmire of various rules, regulations, the different people you must see and so on. And so the Hague Convention idea was to have one relevant authority for each nation or jurisdiction that would sign the treaty, and it was to speed up the process. So what English notaries can do, they generally they wouldn't have it in their heads, obviously, but they'd have the resources. Usually, it's a book called Brooks Notary by a notary named Nigel Reddy, and you can look up any country or jurisdiction in the world in there, and they'll tell you the requirements of that nation in respect of whether they will accept simply the notarization itself without anything else, or in some cases they'll want the notarized document and they want it to have legalization by the relevant Hague authority. Now in the UK, or sorry, in England and Wales, that would be the Foreign Commonwealth Office, same for Scotland, of course, But in the U.S., it'll depend on whether it's a federal document or if it's a state document. So, like, for example, in the state of Florida, you'd be going to the Florida Division of Corporations for an apostille, and I do that for documents I might notarize from here in the U.K. or in the U.S. For use abroad. And of course, here in England and Wales, I would send it to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. It normally takes about 3 or 4 days. It's not a very difficult process. When that comes back, then that either goes to the client as is, or even where the Hague Convention might apply, some nations will still want the extra step of looking for an embassy or consul legalization. And once again, you have to resort to the books or the internet. There is a very good website with a firm of notaries in London called Cheese Rights, and their website is CheesWrights, so it's cheeserights.co.uk/legalization. And you can click there to choose the nation, and it'll tell you what the requirements are. Now, those requirements would apply also to U.S. notaries. Simply the cost would be different, but it would tell you the step that what that nation would require, and if they reference an apostille, would actually be, of course, the U.S. notary's apostille, which must be sought. Does that make sense?
That makes great sense. And Kevin, you know, wow, I mean, with all that, with all those requirements, you know, outside the U.S., but you also mentioned 4.8 million, you know, U.S. notaries, surely, you know, several thousand of those notaries have found their way overseas, right? So, you know, what if the client says, well, why can't I just get a U.S. notary to perform these services in, say, in the U.K.? Can you go through... the practical and legal limitations of that type of question?
Okay. Well, for one thing, I am one, but I'll explain that afterwards. The best thing is to make sure we know the general rule first. The first thing is, of course, the federal government, they would point out that that consular officers of the United States would be the only U.S. authorities who should be permitted to notarize outside of the United States borders, and that they discourage U.S. states from appointing commissioners for oaths who can notarize abroad, and they certainly don't accept a U.S. notary acting abroad themselves. They would require to receive a notarization from a party authorized to notarize documents from within that jurisdiction. So I know, for example, even though the state of Florida has authorized me under Chapter 118 of the Florida Statutes as a Florida international notary, that I can notarize documents intended to be returned back to the U.S., and if parties will accept it in other parts of the U.S., I will notarize those also. But I wouldn't ever attempt to notarize documents to be accompanying a W-7 ITIN application, for example, to the IRS, because they will reject that stamp. Now, it may not be a criminal matter, but the federal authorities, they do not encourage people to do that. The U.S. states, of course, they authorize notary publics to act for only 2 years, and there's always territorial limits for the notary public. Also, for example, in England and Wales, the rule is that that you cannot act as a general notary or advertise yourself as such if you're not actually authorized and regulated by the faculty office of the Archbishop of Canterbury. Which is kind of funny. I know it sounds strange that you have the Church of England being involved in notaries, but this all comes back to Henry VIII and when we broke with Rome over here. So you find many countries that would be the case.
Wow. You know, I can tell you that I'm really familiar with W-7 applications, and you know, there were some big changes that occurred with authentication of, say, foreign passports. A few years ago, and it really caused some pretty big changes here. And I remember, going on some embassy tours. I think the one in Poland, I remember hearing that they were actually notarizing foreign passports for W-7 applications, which I thought, wow, you know, that's not really a high volume place, you know, for for ITINs, for individual taxpayer ID numbers. So that's a really interesting point. Claire, I'm going to turn it over to you for a question and comment.
Yeah, I know that, for example, at the U.S. Embassy in London, they offer some form of notary service at the U.S. Embassy in London. Can you possibly explain how that works and under what circumstances people can use notary services through their local U.S. embassy?
Okay. Well, the notary services through the U.S. embassy are, of course, approved by the federal government. They would be. and that is permitted to be used by both foreign citizens and U.S. citizens. Effectively, you would I can give the website for that, but the website you would go to check to see the availability for the notarial appointments would be at https://evisaforms.state.gov/ACS. And from there, you can click on to make a notary appointment. The problem with the U.S. Embassy site is simply the length of time it normally takes within which to find an appointment. The charge is fairly nominal, I would say, but it, you know, from the U.S. you wouldn't think it is if you're only paying $2 normally over there. The charge is normally, I think, $30, so it may have gone up. But usually you have a wait of about 17 to 21 days. I did just check online today on the site, and they weren't even available for appointments at all for next year. So it's not a very easy place to get to, and better be careful what I'm saying. But what I like to point out to clients is that if they do, you know, go to use the U.S. Embassy notarial services, that they have to, of course, make sure that they follow all the relevant rules there, and there are going to be, you know, armed guards and the kind of thing you don't normally expect to see when you go to see a notary. So it can be a fairly stressful experience for people. And if someone's, for example, looking to close on a property purchase, which is one of the biggest reasons I see and other English notary publics would see a U.S. Individual over here or someone buying property in the U.S., it simply won't be enough time because they've got the closing documents, as you would know, only about 2 or 3 days or maybe 4 days if you're lucky before the closing or completion date, which doesn't leave enough time to go see the U.S. Embassy notaries.
Okay. If I might ask a more flippant question, sometimes when you see documents that have been notarized in other countries, they look very fancy. They have these nice big ribbons on them, and you know they're quite impressive documents. Is there any reason why some of these documents look so much fancier in some countries than others?
There's a number of reasons. Historically, if you can imagine, long before computers and everything else, and then maybe even going back to the Middle Ages, if you were going to be lending money to somebody abroad and you had, you know, some substantial funds here, you would normally want to make sure that that person over there could be identified. And what better person to have identified them than somebody who is an authorized person, public official in that country? And back when, you know, the church was more of a institution in Europe and that, it would be the case that you would have a notary over in Spain, for example, to go have this person identified, and it could be before there were driver's license and passports. A number of people would say, yeah, I've known this person for the last 15, 20 years or whatever it would be. This person would make a record, a protocol record, and there'd be a registry that would be kept by that notary for their whole life. And when a notary would die, in fact, this has always been the case, all notarial records are passed on to other notaries or to the regulator. So you have a huge historical record that notaries have made throughout history. We were not allowed to destroy anything. But the idea behind the ribbon and all of the accoutrements was that with the more work that went into the dressing of the document, the more difficult it would be for somebody else to snip open the bindings to that document, to insert a page or remove a page. So they did all kinds of tips and tricks to try to make that much more difficult to do. Now, the reason why it's done nowadays, it may be simply the notaries trying to bump their hourly rate after some time to be spent. It also can be that, depending upon the nation that it's going to, that the documents are better received. For example, in China or mainland Europe, you know, Spain, Italy, they're going to be received better, whereas they may not be that welcoming of the documents if they are done, for example, in the American way. And we're usually encouraged to know that, you know, the more ribbons you put on certain documents for certain countries, the better it's going to proceed, and that kind of thing.
Kevin, thank you for that. I mean, you had mentioned prior to like in the, I guess in the introduction or maybe in the response to our, the first question about the types of documents. I mean, looking at UK notarization and apostilles, I mean, are there any types of restrictions on the documents that are, that you could submit? And what I mean by that is that, you know, we're more and more becoming a, you know, a bureaucracy, at least in the U.S., and I think as well as overseas, but electronic filing and or limitations on the amount of paper that you can include in filing. In some instances, I know from a tax perspective that where, and here's the big example is that form bank account reports can no longer be paper filed as of the middle of this year, 2013. Now, that creates a problem because we often include what we call reasonable cause statements, and now I've had to tell overseas clients to get those documents. I would prefer an apostille, you know, in the event that I need to pull it out and use it. I think it's I guess higher up the chain. Though you might please chime in and tell me no or that's right or whatever. So is there, going back to my original question / comment, I mean, if I say, okay, I need a letter, you know, that's there that I need to sort of set in stone and record in stone that will be respected, you know, for U.S. federal purposes, that is, you know, as to the time those representations were made, would that be okay for getting it notarized?
Well, I couldn't speak to the fact as to what the federal government would require now with the records of bank statements to be filed online. It sounds like the FBAR requirements being changed and that sort of thing. But I can see the point. I think that what you asked makes a lot of sense in that they were able to accept notarial documents in the past when you could send the actual document in. Certainly to go and do the extra step should only help the chance that those documents would be accepted. Because by having the document have an apostille attached to it, it only makes it more obvious that it's a real document.
Right.
Now, as to the actual meaning of a document being apostilled, the apostille is really only, with regard to a notarized document, certifying that the notary is, in fact, a true and proper notary acting currently at that time. So it doesn't actually speak to the truth of the document or any of the facts asserted in the document. But even beyond that, I think it definitely clarifies the time that the document was signed. And every Hague Convention authority has to issue a number when they issue an apostille. So, again, it does tie in and makes it much more difficult for the government to argue that that this wasn't done at a certain time or that it wasn't properly notarized.
That's important, and that was my point. And not with regular, you know, FBAR filings, which I mean there shouldn't be any letter, but for back ones where you would have the client say, okay, this is the reason why I didn't file my FBARs on time, and you used to send a letter, like in, the client would write the letter and they would sign off on it, and you would include it, and it would be dated, and so there was no evidentiary issue. Now you can't include the letter, and so, you know, sometimes you have to prove, you want to protect the client and say, okay, the client's just not jimmying up this letter, you know, in response to an audit request that's coming through saying, yeah, of course, you know, it's February 2015, and you say, of course, I signed it on December the 12th, 2013, with, you know, fingers crossed on their back. I mean, not that we would practice law that way, but, I mean, that's, you know, you want to prevent that type of perception. We're getting close to closing the podcast today. Kevin, I will cede the floor to you for a few minutes for any last comments.
Well, one thing, just from an immigration perspective, I think that there are times when American lawyers are going to look to find proof of someone's academic qualifications or facts relating to their status abroad and so on. And in those situations, I think that a notary abroad would be a very good person to address, to go and actually make a statement. Generally, as in the U.S., the notary statement of facts or authentic act have a heavier weight than the person themselves. And where they can go and get authorization from the authorities in relation to degrees and other academic achievements and so on, this is going to help bolster the acceptability of those documents. One thing that can happen with these academic degrees, though, is that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, for example, in the UK, they will not allow a notary to simply certify something as a copy. They're going to want to make sure that the notary has, in fact, checked against the list of registered universities and to contact the university to make sure that that person actually received that diploma. There are many situations like that where the FCO the Hague Convention Authority are pushing these extra things to be done. That can delay the work to be done a little bit, but it can, I think, bolster the weight of the documentation, at least for those who are aware of what it is that the FCO would do. With regard to notarization abroad, I touched upon the fact that there are some notaries abroad, like myself. A Florida civil law notary is statutorily permitted to notarize abroad under Florida law. The only other state I know that can do this is New York. I know of a New York lawyer based in London who, because he has a legal office in New York, is also permitted to notarize outside New York borders. Doesn't mention whether or not you can notarize outside of the U.S. borders, however, but he does notarize as a U.S. Notary in New York. I myself, of course, practice in Bristol. He in London. I know of a Florida civil law notary in Germany. But beyond the three of us, I'm not aware of any U.S. notaries that are, in fact, notarizing abroad. But it could be useful to keep in mind these people. Obviously, you have my name, Kevin Burke. My phone number is 0845-519-4982. Website is www.americanattorneyservices.co.uk. There is another Florida civil law notary whose name you can find from the NACLN website, and the name of the notary in London, his website is dottedlineglobal.com. His name is Keith Rooney, and he's obviously a New York lawyer. But that can be of some benefit for those that are desperate, and there isn't time to make an appointment with the U.S. Embassy.
Kevin, thank you so much for that. That's very, very helpful. It's always good to have a contact point where we can receive additional information because, I mean, you're right. I find myself in need of non-U.S. notarization services. It's generally one of those things like it's not one of those things that you come across at the very beginning planning stages. It's like, oh, no, I've got to get this. And so, yes, many times there's a hint of desperation in terms of the services that we need. Well, that's the completion of today's podcast. I want to thank Kevin Burke from American Attorney Services in Bristol in the UK for being our special guest panelist here. I also would like to thank Lindsay Kershaw and Claire Nielsen from the Rome District Chapter's Practice Management Committee as serving as our panelists. Thank you both, as always. I also like to give a special acknowledgement here to Goldstein and Lee PC in New York, who at the last minute, due to a schedule change on my end, hosted me while I was traveling for this podcast. They've been very gracious in that regard. This is the American Immigration Lawyers Association, Rome District Chapter, and this has been the podcast on apostilles and notarization outside the United States. Thank you for joining us.